Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Well, to say we're all going through something we hadn't counted on is an understatement. We wondered, how are these sudden changes brought on by the coronavirus pandemic messing with our emotions, our minds? So we put these questions to Teresa Botts and Melinda Moore, EKU psychologists who host our series on mental health issues in Kentucky. First, Dr. Botts.
I'd like to begin by addressing the question, how has our lives changed in the face of this pandemic? We're in the grips of an unprecedented global pandemic that has upended most of our lives in ways that just a few months ago would have been unfathomable. For many people, they are experiencing great uncertainty in the face of many different types of losses, and these are triggering a range of emotions, including anxiety, depression, and grief, all of which are normal reactions to loss. These unexpected losses are shattering our underlying conventional assumptions about our world as we once knew it. Since the first case of COVID-19 was diagnosed, there have been unmatched efforts to institute the practice of physical or social distancing in countries all over the world, including right here at home in Kentucky. People are having to isolate themselves from others, endure quarantining, and are only venturing out for necessities and emergencies. In light of all the daily challenges that we are having to face in response to the current pandemic, we are all forced to confront what many are referring to as the new normal. We all have our own ways of defensively reacting to this new normal. Some will respond by becoming excessively guarded and protecting their vulnerability, while others will utilize denial and throw caution to the wind, ignoring orders to isolate because they are not ready to deal with the realities wrought by this disease. As these new measures and orders have been introduced in our lives, and stricter limits imposed on our physical contact with one another, there have been more and more disruptions in our daily routines. And from week to week, our world seems a little stranger as the number of new cases of the disease have increased and the death count continues to escalate. In light of these changes, we must struggle to find a balance between our work life and family care demands, because for many of us, these demands are all having to be met under the same roof. A life that once seemed relatively predictable is no longer so. And we don't have control over our own lives that we once assumed, causing us to search for a narrative that will enable us to make sense of this experience from personal, spiritual, social, economic, and cultural perspectives. During normal times, we would have an arsenal of support systems in place to help us deal with a crisis situation. And these would include physical contact and support from our family, friends, and coworkers, our churches and religious organizations. But with this global pandemic, because of the order to isolate, these familiar systems of support are being challenged. Indeed, women are having to give birth alone without their partners present. If we get sick and have to go to the hospital, our loved ones can't be by our side. If death occurs, we can't even follow our usual funeral and burial practices in which loved ones are by each other's side to provide comfort. So let us just reflect on how much and how quickly our world has changed in the past month. Our elementary, middle school, and high school age children have gone to strictly online instruction, as have our college students who were forced to quickly leave their campuses with little to no preparation or forewarning. As noted earlier, a significant number of us are having to work out of our homes. We're engaging in remote faith practices and services, not to mention having to manage financial uncertainties. To top it off, we not only have to try to manage our fears of contracting the virus ourselves, but we also have to worry about our family and friends contracting it. And perhaps the most difficult experience of all is having to grieve over the loss of someone when COVID-19 claims the lives of a friend or a loved one. And again, all this is occurring in the context of having to sever physical contact with family members not residing in our households, friends, and coworkers. This is our plight. So you may ask, what is the focus of this episode on mental health issues? In the face of all this uncertainty, it is easy to feel overwhelmed and helpless. But today we want to bring a message of hope and empowerment by examining our plight from a realistic but strength-based perspective. We want to examine how people are struggling to make sense of their current situation. How are people doing? What are they thinking and feeling? In examining these questions, we will be forced to take a closer look at what some are calling existential anxiety or angst. We will make every effort to look at the reality of our situation, which may at first seem to take on a somewhat dark and pessimistic overtone as we talk about grief and loss. But in the end, our goal is to empower our audience by helping them to recreate their own narrative, find new meaning in their suffering, and move them toward a more positive perspective that highlights the power of the human spirit and resiliency in the face of stressors. Our goal is to show how finding new meaning in our current crisis situation can lead to post-traumatic growth experiences and help ameliorate the longer-term psychological effects of this pandemic. So you may say, but I find myself thinking and feeling things that are not characteristic of me. Is this normal? So I'll start by noting that whatever you are thinking and feeling in response to the current pandemic is normal. One way to conceptualize the thoughts and feelings which you may see as atypical for you is to view them from the perspective of you are having normal reactions to an abnormal experience. And I think we all can agree that this COVID-19 pandemic is definitely an abnormal experience. With that said, I'd like everyone to realize that there is no such thing as inappropriate emotions in response to it all. Indeed, you may find yourself experiencing an array of thoughts and emotions. Our existential experiences can range from vague uneasiness, worry, concern, angst, perceived meaninglessness, fear of the unknown, hopelessness, fear of non-being, and even mortal terror. These feelings and thoughts center around our questioning of our very existence and are commonly experienced during times of uncertainty. Just allow yourself to experience each as a thought or feeling to the fullest and without defense. Try to give yourself permission to experience the range of feelings and avoid passing judgment on yourself and others as well, as they may also be experiencing varying emotional responses to what is truly a trying situation. Remember to be kind to yourself and others as we all adapt to the new normal. Realize that the fear and anxiety that you may be experiencing are not a reflection of weakness. They are normal reactions. Again, just allow yourself to feel what you're experiencing in the moment and don't pass judgment. In all likelihood, there are many others experiencing similar reactions, thoughts, and feelings. So many of us will raise the question, how can we survive this pandemic and these many changes in our day-to-day lives? One major suggestion is to create a plan to stay connected and supported. Keep in mind that continuing to have social contact is very important. Just because we are forced to maintain physical distance doesn't mean we can't stay socially connected. It is important to keep in contact with people close to you by telephone or even via video connect resources such as FaceTime, Zoom, Skype, Google Hangouts, the WhatsApp, or maybe some more common mediums like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and even TikTok. However, be sure to make good use of social media and avoid making offensive posts. It is in everyone's best interest to post stories of inspiration and hope whenever possible. It is a priority to keep in touch with people who care about you. Identify who you can contact for support when you need it. Because as with any crisis situation, it takes a village to move from just surviving to once again thriving. In sum, all day-to-day functioning as we knew it has been shut down. While these steps may be critical to mitigate the spread of this disease, they have undoubtedly had consequences on short-term and potentially long-term mental health functioning and well-being. As humans, we are social creatures. We are hardwired for it. In the words of the great Dalai Lama, 14th, we human beings are social beings. We come into the world as the result of others' actions. We survive here in dependence on others. Whether we like it or not, there's hardly a moment of our lives when we do not benefit from others' activities. For this reason, it is hardly surprising that most of our happiness arises in the context of our relationships with others.
Dr. Teresa Botts, and joining us now is her colleague in the EKU Department of Psychology, Dr. Melinda Moore.
Isolation has its own consequences. As noted earlier, grief is one such consequence. We know that grief from the loss of anything you are attached to can create a grief reaction. Losing a job, income, or loss of a social sphere or cherished activity. These are losses we are all experiencing. Depressed behavior is also another consequence. Staying in your pajamas all day long, not having a set schedule, losing track of time and days. Again, these are things we all may be experiencing. Isolation under the yoke of a worldwide pandemic that threatens the lives of everyone may lead to even more existential angst. The distress may even get so bad that some might contemplate suicide. Over 48,000 Americans die by suicide every year. Over 700 Kentuckians die by suicide every year. So the fear of suicidal thinking and behavior increases is a real one based on facts that already exist. What we know from previous large-scale disasters, whether sudden and traumatic, such as 9/11, natural or environmental, are almost always accompanied by increases in depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorder, domestic violence, and child abuse. George Bonanno's research in the aftermath of 9/11 also told us that people were far more resilient than we gave them credit for being. In a study 6 months after 9/11, he found that people were functioning well and were more resilient than expected. However, the biggest predictor of resilience was social support. That is having people in your social network that can provide support and comfort, presumably in person and face-to-face. That's why these practices of social or physical distancing may be a game changer. Still, the emotional impact of this crisis is hard to know, because the data simply are not available. Most are anecdotal or informal reports. For instance, the National Crisis Text Line is reporting a significant increase in volume, depending upon the day. They are reporting an increase of people texting them from 47% to 116% of their usual volume. About one in five texters is mentioning the coronavirus specifically, and anxiety is the top issue for them at the moment. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline reports that they have not experienced a significant change in call volume, although they grant it may shift as they move through the stages of the disaster. On the other hand, the Disaster Distress Helpline, a subnetwork of the Lifeline focused on providing emotional support to people affected by disasters, has experienced significant volume increases. We simply do not know the consequences, but we would like to hear from you. What have you, as an Eastern Standard listener, a WEKU community member, experienced? What are you willing to share? Please email us at es@eku.edu, and we would like to share your story on the air.
We'll be watching for those emails. Doctors Teresa Botts and Melinda Moore, members of the faculty of the EKU Department of Psychology. WEKU is now providing a daily 10-minute coronavirus update hosted by Kelly McEvers. NPR's Coronavirus Daily Podcast is available at weku.org. Just look for the blue coronavirus link and click the Listen Now tab to hear the latest stories. The program is available wherever you listen to podcasts and, of course, on weku.org. In a moment, bridge funding for businesses that have been helping revive the main streets of Eastern Kentucky.
We were able to put together about $460,000 initially for the fund that could go out in small mini grants of up to $3,000 and also in 0% interest loans that could go up to $10,000.
How the state's vast network of nonprofits is navigating the coronavirus crisis.
The needs are diverse, and it's so difficult to kind of wrap your head around and quantify for the entire sector as a whole.
And one city that has a post-COVID-19 plan.
A very strong focus from the community is empowering youth and giving them opportunities to come back and have good jobs and have a good quality of life.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
It can be tough enough to run a business on a good day, but during a pandemic, with a close sign hanging on the front door and no idea when you'll be able to flip it over and tell the world you're open again. Well, these Kentucky businesses are very much on the mind of Laura Smith these days. Laura is executive director of the Appalachian Impact Fund, an Eastern Standard production sponsor, and she has worked with other organizations to create the Kentucky Business Stimulus Fund, supporting businesses hit by the coronavirus crisis. Greetings, Laura.
Hello.
So, Laura, I'm certain any business that's reeling right now in this crisis will want us to get straight to the information, to the facts, so let's do that. First, if you could, tell us how this fund was organized, where the money is coming from, and who are the players?
Sure. So the Southeast Kentucky Downtown Business Stimulus Fund was the creation of the Appalachian Impact Fund at the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and our partners at CEDIC. And our partners at Invest 606. And the three of us came together and knew that we had to do something to respond immediately to small businesses in Eastern Kentucky, many of them being left behind by some of the federal relief programs. So AIF, the Appalachian Impact Fund, and CEDIC put together a pot of money that we already had, repositioned it for this fund, and then we went out and sought other partners, including the James Graham Brown Foundation in Louisville, who made a major investment into the fund. And in total, we were able to put together about $460,000 initially for the fund that could go out in small mini grants of up to $3,000 and also in 0% interest loans that could go up to $10,000.
Okay, and for listeners who might not know, CEDIC is?
CEDIC is the Community Economic Development Institute for Kentucky. They are housed at the University of Kentucky in Lexington.
Okay, so your fund is flush with cash and you've begun writing checks. What's the criteria that has to be met in order to qualify?
Sure. So you need to be a business that's locally owned and located in a downtown in a certain geography of Southeast Kentucky. And you can look at a map and see which counties are included on our website. And you need to add to the economy through being a restaurant, unique retail, accommodations, arts and culture, those types of unique businesses that really stabilize a downtown and make them a unique place that people can enjoy who live there and also attract visitors into the downtown.
Okay, and we'll put a link to that map on your website, on ours, on esweku.org. But in case somebody can't get there, what is the web address?
So they can get to it from CEDIC's homepage, which is cedic.ca.uky.edu.
Okay, and CEDIC is spelled C-E-D-I-K.
That's right.
Laura, before this crisis so rapidly turned out to be a bull in a china shop, there was some downtown revitalization happening in some communities in Eastern Kentucky. And in a moment, we're going to hear from one of those business owners, Mandy Scheffel of the Spotted Newt Bookstore, which just opened recently in Hazard. But if you could tell us what you're hearing from the main streets of Eastern Kentucky.
Right. So, you know, downtown revitalization and entrepreneurship, small business, had been one of the bright spots during this economic transition in Eastern Kentucky. And so with COVID coming in and many of those businesses being forced to shut down and then those being deemed essential, like some of our restaurants, really struggling to stay open at this point, many of them closed, there was a real fear that we were losing some of the momentum and that many of these businesses who were small startups, some of them launched just in the past year, wouldn't be able to return once the state does reopen. So that was a big motivating factor for us. And I know that businesses are getting innovative. We have businesses that are able to do curbside or have changed their model to serve their customers in a different way. But many have had to close their doors at this point and are unsure if they're going to be able to cover you know, their utilities, their rent, all of the things that keep becoming due every month, and also have the working capital to start up again. And so that's one of the reasons that we launched the fund and called it a stimulus fund as opposed to just a relief or a recovery or emergency fund, because we want to make sure that our businesses not only weather this storm, but are well positioned to have the working capital they need to reopen when the time comes that it's safe to do so.
You know, as bad as this thing is, and it's so pervasive, it is uplifting. It is heartening to discover the innovation and the ingenuity that's going on as a result of it.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, you're going to see that from several Eastern Kentucky businesses. I mean, the thing that gives me hope is Eastern Kentuckians have a lot of grit. To be an entrepreneur in Eastern Kentucky right now is not an easy feat on a good day. Mm-hmm. So people have always had to be really creative and innovative, and we're seeing that happen too. And so I think that many of the businesses that we funded through the stimulus fund that have gotten the $3,000 grants or have gotten a $10,000 loan, they're going to make it. I have a lot of faith that they're going to be able to open back up when that time comes and are going to be well positioned to be stronger moving forward, because they've just weathered a really stressful and difficult time for their business and learned some things about how to pivot and how to move and how to be flexible during this time.
Laura Smith, Executive Director of the Appalachian Impact Fund, part of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, sponsors of Eastern Standard and also supporters of WEKU. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me.
Businesses were beginning to appear on the main streets of Eastern Kentucky communities when word of a pandemic led to where we find ourselves now. I mentioned that we would be talking with one of those business owners, Mandy Scheffel, who recently, and only just before the coronavirus crisis hit hard, opened the Red Spotted Newt, a bookstore on East Main Street in downtown Hazard. Greetings, Mandy.
Thanks for having me.
And first, the name of your shop. How did you come up with that?
So that newt is a fixture here in Eastern Kentucky and the whole eastern part of the United States, the Red Spotted Newt. It's held a special place for me most of my childhood. I enjoyed catching the red spotted newt. It has the bright orange color with the red spots, so it really sticks out against the landscape here. And I was just fascinated by it my whole life. So I spent a majority of my childhood in the creek catching the red spotted newt. And a lot of that time was spent with my grandfather, who has since passed. So it was kind of a nod to him. And remembering a childhood fondly.
Tell us, Mandy, how has this virus crisis affected you and your business?
Well, it's totally changed the way I had to go about operating. I closed my store to in-store traffic on March the 17th. So at that point, I switched to social media because I had only been open a couple of months. And I hadn't gotten to the point where I had a website that was up and viable. So I switched to social media and started taking orders strictly through Facebook and Instagram. And initially thinking that this was a temporary thing, you know, we wouldn't have to do this for long. But since that's become my new focus, is getting a website for the store and getting up online.
So it sounds to me as though any message that you would have for small business owners that are in the same situation that you are in is to think it through, work it out. There seems to be some innovation and some ingenuity going on out there, people coming up with workarounds. Are you hearing that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really put a lot of small business owners into, we've been forced to adapt and change day to day, really, for me. I've had to think about different ways to ship and obviously taking this to the next level, not being content with just keeping this as a social media thing. Hey, shoot me a message if you want to order a book. That I needed to take it to the next level. Realistically, we don't have a timeline for this. You know, there is still no timeline for, okay, here's the day when people can come back into your store.
Mm-hmm. It's just an open-ended question right now.
Yeah, very much so.
As an independent bookstore, how are you competing with the likes of Amazon?
Well, I don't know that I can from a price standpoint, but, and this is where the pandemic has really hit hard for me. the vision for the bookstore was not just a place to buy books. It was a space for regional authors, writers, poets, artists to be able to showcase their work, to get together and share their work with the community. And yeah, it was nice to be able to get a book there too. So that's the part where I felt like I had an upper hand on Amazon, because Amazon can't offer that community. And so now when you shift to, okay, I'm buying this book online, you're missing that whole element of the business model, which was the community. So that's been the tough part for me, is that my vision was not to sell books online. It was to create a space in the community.
So you're really more an event business.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I wanted that to be a big cornerstone of the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
With the readings, writing workshops, poetry nights, I mean, that was going to be a huge part of my business, or I hoped it would be.
Well, let's hope we get back there someday soon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I think everybody is looking forward to that. But in the meantime, I think it's great that people are having this opportunity to kind of relax and maybe get some reading done that they weren't getting done prior.
I'm hearing an awful lot of that going on out there, and that bodes well for you.
Seems to be, yeah.
Okay, well, Mandy Scheffel, owner of the Red Spotted Newt Bookstore in Hazard, we thank you for your time, Mandy.
Thank you so much.
Now, to get a feel for how this COVID-19 crisis is playing out in the nonprofit world, we turn to Daniel Klor, Executive Director and CEO of Kentucky Nonprofit Network. Thanks for joining us, Daniel.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Daniel, you have results from some recent surveys of our nonprofits. First, painting the picture in broad strokes, what conclusions have you reached about what's in store for nonprofits in these conditions?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen a sector over the years that is certainly resilient and innovative, and the organizations who can embrace that environment now are the ones who are doing the best that they can with the current situation and hopefully will survive and thrive on the other side of this crisis. We certainly know that we will lose some organizations as a result of this. Some will shut their doors. Some will have to rebuild from scratch, and others will survive it, and we will probably see some mergers. So it is hard to have that crystal ball, but overall, we're, as always, really inspired by the sector and the work that they're doing.
Okay, let's look at the landscape out there. And to paint this portrait, we're using statistics that you gathered in a couple of surveys of these organizations. Mm-hmm. And you found, first of all, an estimated loss of 19% of total annual revenue. And that's even as expenses rise as a result of the crisis. Can you put that number in perspective for us?
Yeah, it's really, you know, the nonprofit sector is so diverse. So you've got some organizations who are actually seeing an increase in demand for services. So obviously you would think of food banks, food pantries, organizations that are really kind of quote unquote front lines, people who provide rent assistance, et cetera. So those are organizations who are seeing an increased demand and not necessarily an increase in revenue. They may actually have had to cancel a fundraising event, for example, and so they're really struggling. Then you have organizations who have had to, because of loss of revenue, just cease providing services altogether. It's just impossible for, you know, for them to do that. There are others who are kind of in the middle a bit, that they have been able to kind of shift gears and provide things via telehealth or shift to performances online, even though they may or may not be able to charge for those for some arts organizations. So it's really difficult to kind of quantify that. So, you know, the challenge, though, we know for organizations who have, in fact, seen an increase in costs, the likelihood that they're recouping those is very you know, dismal, you know, there in particular. So to give an example, you might have a residential children's facility. And so they may have had kids in their care who were going to public school and were being mainstreamed. Well, now that's not happening. And so they've had to hire an entirely new shift of workers during the day when kids were typically at school. Well, the reimbursement for those services has not changed. So for them, that's really critical. For others who are now having to buy PPE, do more disinfecting than they ever have before to try to keep folks safe, you know, that's a new crisis. So the needs are diverse, and it's so difficult to kind of wrap your head around and quantify for the entire sector as a whole.
The survey found staff furloughs, layoffs, hours, and pay cuts, more than half of the nonprofits surveyed reducing services. How does that impact the communities that they serve?
Well, you're talking about direct impact on Kentuckians, you know, so in some instances, those are services that are impacting people right now. But what we're, you know, people are saying, oh, we want to give and support organizations who are meeting the needs now, and certainly understand that. But you also look at direct services that still matter, you know, and that you want to be sure are in and available in our communities on the other side of this. So organizations like CASA, court-appointed special advocates. Those are kids who are going through the court system. And so you might not think of that as, quote, frontline, but those are ultimately kids who are still going to be in the court system and need those services and volunteers. Camps, you know, or, you know, I mean, again, it's you think of those as, oh, you know, camp or the arts or environmental organizations, which is appropriate as we talk on Earth Day, you know, are maybe not necessarily, quote unquote, front lines, but they are vitally important to the kinds of communities where we want to live and see thrive in a post-COVID-19 environment.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these organizations are literally lifelines for people. You mentioned CASA, mm-hmm. for example. That's a good example. Mm-hmm. Domestic violence shelters, those
yes.
sorts of places.
Yeah. Absolutely. And those are, you know, we know organizations, domestic violence shelters, organizations that serve kids who are abused and neglected, you know, and they report and quote, eerie silence. And so they know that there are people who need their services, yet you know, how to access them in this environment is challenging. And so, you know, they're, you know, open for, you know, domestic violence shelters are still open. Children's advocacy centers are still open. So those folks in crisis are still there. But for example, in the issue around kids, you know, their typical front line of intervention for child abuse and neglect are their school teachers, and they don't have that right now. So it's really frightening to think of some of the needs that we will certainly be facing as a society, again, on the other side of this. And you're absolutely right. They will be increasing for many.
In your surveying, you found that a significant portion of Kentucky's nonprofits have less than 3 months' cash reserves on hand. And the impulse, of course, is to get out there and raise money. But mm-hmm. in these times, is that possible? Is it feasible?
Well, it is, and we're encouraged. There are folks, you know, who have received their stimulus check for the government and don't need that. And so they have been very generous, and you see many of that, you know, work playing out online where they're donating to charity. So I know folks are incredibly appreciative of that. And then there is, in the CARES Act, a small charitable giving tax incentive that we hope people will be taking advantage of. So for people who do not itemize their charitable giving deductions, there's a $300 tax credit that they would receive per person, $600 per couple. So that is some incentive to give. We are lobbying at the federal level for more to increase that incentive and to make it retroactive so that people could actually claim it on their 2019 taxes that we'll all be doing by July 15th. So we're looking into that. We will host Kentucky Gives Day, which is our 8th annual event, which is coming up on May 12th. And we're really looking forward to that because even small donations, every donation is going to count and help organizations. And, you know, as you mentioned, those who are not, quote unquote, frontline are hesitant right now to ask. But again, we know that they have people who are very passionate about what they do. So we're excited to be able to at least offer them this platform and this collective day of action across Kentucky where nonprofits and Kentuckians can come together and really rally around what we value and what we think is important for our community.
Is this situation forcing changes in or even the abandonment of current business or operating models? What succeeds these structures?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I don't know that we know for sure, but we do know that there have been some changes, some shifts to telehealth, for example, that we hope to maintain post-COVID-19. You know, there have been a lot of regulations over the years that have prevented some kind of usage of technology, et cetera. And so now that we've crossed over, we don't want to go back. So that's going to be really important. You know, I think the other thing that we've seen are a lot of inequities in both health and race and rural and urban and broadband. You know, if you are without broadband right now, you are really not able to connect to education, to healthcare, to news. I think this situation has really brought a lot of that many of us knew was out there, but definitely to the forefront. And so I think those are things we're going to have to really tackle and deal with. But again, organizations who have been able to shift gears and get online have really been able to pivot. And it's almost, that's almost an overused word during this situation, but they have. But again, you still have individuals, families who cannot access those services, even if they are available online. So there are going to be some challenges around that. And you know, I know I was on a national call today where they're talking about an infrastructure bill at the federal level, and infrastructure must include broadband. If we've ever seen before where this broadband has been critical, it's been this situation. Again, it's impacted healthcare, schools, educate, everything.
I think of it as almost connective tissue. I think we take the nonprofit ecosystem for granted sometimes. And I wonder if you could help us comprehend what a weakened nonprofit environment means to our culture and to our society.
I think you're exactly right. It is easy, I think, for us to overlook the ways that nonprofits impact us on a daily basis. And so there is that impact with regard to society. And again, nonprofits are really essential to everything that we value in a healthy community and the kind of community where businesses want to operate. You know, it's quality healthcare, it's quality education, it's access to the arts, it's a protected environment. It's a voice for people who feel like they aren't heard. It's childcare. You know, I mean, it's all of those things. But I think, Tom, what's probably most overlooked is the economic impact. Nonprofits employ 1 in 10 Kentuckians. We are the fourth largest private sector industry in Kentucky. And most people don't realize that. It's over $7.5 billion in annual wages. So when nonprofits are shutting their doors, cutting their services, laying off and furloughing staff, those are taxpaying Kentuckians. They're employers too. So nonprofits are critical to our quality of life and everything that we enjoy about living in Kentucky. And they're also more than charity. They're also employers. And so it's kind of a double whammy. You know, when for-profits close down, you know, yes, there's the economic impact, but what is the quality of life impact? And sometimes there is one and sometimes there isn't. It just happens to be your favorite restaurant. So I think that's the piece that we really want to help people understand is, yes, they're vital services, or sometimes they're not necessarily vital, but they're important to us because they're causes we care about. But there's also a real economic impact. Those are employees, employers with families, and, you know, they're losing their income in this scenario too. So we are here at the Kentucky Nonprofit Network to be their voice and their advocate and try to help them, you know, weather this storm, those that can, and thrive on the other side.
Well, going forward, we're looking at a lot of uncertainty ahead. And if we can, Danielle, I'd like to check in with you from time to time just to see how it's going in the nonprofit world.
Absolutely. Would be happy to do that and appreciate, again, the opportunity to tell these stories. These are organizations who, as you mentioned, are facing a lot of uncertainty. A lot are hurting. But again, there are so many who are worthy of support and are doing incredible and innovative things during this time. And so I hope folks will reach out and ask how they can help. They're even trying to figure out how to take advantage of virtual volunteers right now, because even folks who want to volunteer are having a hard time doing that. So we are eager to see these organizations kind of shift and take advantage of the wonderful generosity that is happening all across Kentucky.
Danielle Clore, Executive Director, CEO of Kentucky Nonprofit Network. Thank you, Danielle.
Thanks, Tom.
What does the future hold? In the months before COVID-19 became a household term, one Eastern Kentucky city decided to come up with a plan. Once the people in a town or a city decide they need to make some big changes, success can depend on whether they have a roadmap that everybody has agreed to and will now support and follow. Hazard made that decision, and in 2019, the Kentucky League of Cities was called upon to guide the development of a strategic plan for Hazard. Tad Long is the Director of Community Development Services at the League, and he joins us by phone in this time of the coronavirus and social distancing to fill us in on the details of that plan. Welcome, Tad.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be with you.
Hazard's been a center for the coal industry for as long as anybody can remember, but the industry, of course, has been in steady decline for decades, and with that decline have come shrinking production and job losses. Have the people of Hazard made peace with that, and are they looking to move beyond coal?
I think it's a complex answer. I'm not going to say that they've made peace with that, but they are ready to move beyond coal, if that makes sense. I think it's Hazard has been an economic engine in Eastern Kentucky for decades, and you know, transitioning to something else is never easy. But the leadership, not just elected leadership, but folks that make decisions and try to move the community forward, have just determined that it's time for us to look in different directions and hopefully still maintain our coal heritage.
Before we get into the details of the plan, let's give credit where credit is due. Who deserves credit for pulling together a planning process and seeing to it that it's completed?
Well, I think it starts with the mayor, Mayor Happy Movellini, and I love that name, Happy, and the commissioners started talking with us about this in January of last year. And Betsy Clemens, who heads the Chamber of Commerce, has kind of been a linchpin in terms of she knows everybody and where everybody is, and she has been they coordinated the funding for this. And then I also want to talk about the Perry County Judge Executive Scott Alexander, who was really a strong partner in developing this.
Okay, Tad. And you did a SWOT analysis, which looks at Hazard strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Can you give us what you found in a nutshell?
In terms of strengths, there is a strong community of nonprofit organizations that have helped to undergird the community as jobs have come and then gone. And as people have become sick, the health infrastructure is very strong there. The schools and educational partners are working well together. In terms of some of the challenges, the lack of organized recreation and transportation is an issue. You have a lot of folks coming in to get treatment at ARH, and they don't have transportation to get back to where they came from, and that creates some issues. Something else that came out is that people seem to work in silos, and they focus on what they're tasked to do, and so they don't talk as often as they need to. And then, as in most communities, apathy. Just getting people involved is always a challenge. Some of the opportunities, a very strong focus from the community is empowering youth and giving them opportunities to come back and have good jobs and have a good quality of life. Hazard and Perry County is the center for adventure tourism. They have lots of opportunities there. The drone port is a tremendous opportunity in looking at future jobs. And again, the healthcare industry is very strong. Some of the threats, people are very aware of stereotypes, and they're trying to break the mold in terms of how they've been viewed at times in the past, and they want to be a forward-looking city, and they see that as something that really needs to happen. They see shifting the mindset of community members to see that there are opportunities here as a critical factor in making the community succeed. The downtown has some problems, both with lack of business and being in the floodplain, and they need to reclaim some higher-paying jobs that have been lost because of the decline in coal. So that's it in a nutshell.
People are often resistant to change. Of course, that's really being put to the test these days with the coronavirus situation, but generally that's a truism, I think. How receptive to making big changes have you found the people of Hazard?
Well, the thing that impressed me about Hazard, and this is something that I don't see every day, is they are winners. They understand what their past has been in terms of being an economic center, and they see this just as a new challenge. They've embraced the fact that they need to take care of people who have lost jobs or have health issues, people who have substance addiction. So all of those things have caused change for a while. And this is just another part of the change. And every single leader, and when we had citizen groups and meetings, everybody's ready to move on. I won't say that that's universal, but I will say for the people that we talked with and the people that are in decision-making roles are ready to change. It has to happen.
You talk with high school students and you ask them what they would like to see change or what they would like to see come to their town. What did you hear from them?
Well, there's the usual things you'll hear, like we need things to do. They really want to see the downtown be the center of everything. They talked about how it's the symbol of the community and it should be the primary gathering spaces, and they would like to see the downtown be vibrant again. They were very honest about cleaning up the town. There's some burned out buildings, dilapidated, abandoned buildings that they see need to be changed. And then another thing that was mentioned several times was there aren't enough sidewalks. The sidewalk will just end, and then there'll be 500 feet, 1,000 feet till the sidewalk starts again. So they really want sidewalks to connect all areas of the town so they can get around, easily.
You mentioned cleanup there, and I know that you found that the city does offer resources and tools to encourage people to clean up their properties, and there are consequences if they don't. How's that working out?
You know, I think that they're making a lot of progress, actually. It's a carrot and stick approach. It seems that several of the property owners are getting on board with making plans to rehab their buildings. But the city has also stepped up code enforcement, and they are stiffening the penalties for not doing that. I think that people see that, and then it becomes a source of pride within the community. We need our community to be clean. We need our community to look good when people come in. We need it to look good for the people that live here. And they've made a lot of strides. They still have a long way to go, but they have put ordinances in place to help enforce results.
In your report, you note that people are just tired of meetings, and especially those that have no clear purpose and don't produce tangible results, and that this needs to change. Are you seeing a shift to some sort of approach that won't leave people feeling that their time has been wasted or that would leave them with burnout?
Well, anybody that knows happy knows that happy is not happy going to more meetings. And so he is a results-oriented man. He is principal of a high school there at Hazard, and he believes in making the plan and action resulting. And he doesn't understand. He says, I can't understand why things can't get done faster. So we did work with the mayor and the commission on creating a way to keep track of things that are going on, who's responsible, what's the due date, and bringing more accountability to projects and the plans that they have in place. You know, the mayor is a big proponent, and so is the county judge, of calling together a summit. He said, I don't like meetings, but we need to have a sit down and bring folks to the table and break out into groups and talk about who's doing what and get everybody on the same page. So it's not that he's opposed, or the community is not opposed to meetings. It's just they want efficiency in the meetings and they want an outcome. And I'm kind of in agreement with that myself.
In the conclusion of the report, you point out that the challenge with this plan has been that so many things are happening so fast in Hazard. And the list of accomplishments is really pretty long. Can you give us some highlights?
Hazard may be the fastest moving city I have ever worked in. And it's not the only one, but we had to revise
constantly the plan to get it right because there is so much happening. One of the big things in the plan talks about what the city government needs to do versus what the city itself, the residents, need to do. The number one thing that the city has to do is take care of the water problem. The water infrastructure is in really critical condition. So that was one of the first things that we talked about. They'd gotten, I think, 3 grants recently and several million dollars, and they're going to replace their water infrastructure and their wastewater treatment department. And that is a huge step forward, not only for the residents, which is most important, but when you have folks come in from out of town that you're recruiting to locate there or help to develop jobs there, and they see on the television boil water advisory, that is not a good look. So that's the number one thing that I'm really most proud of the city for doing. They have really gotten on the water situation, but they've done a lot of other things. There's new jobs that have come, 300 new jobs coming. They got the gas line out to the industrial park, which will be a big help in recruiting business. They got $750,000 for a planning grant to do sidewalks in Walkertown. They put more money into cleaning up the street, and the city amphitheater is scheduled to be completed. The stage will be completed this year. They passed alcohol sales. I mean, the list is literally endless of the things they accomplished just last year.
It's kind of challenging to get your head out that far, isn't it? With all the fluidity of the situation and the enormity of it, it's very difficult to think that far ahead.
It is, and no one knows for sure how long that's going to last. And then there's the things we don't know. We know it's going to impact the economy, and that is really going to put cities in a pinch in terms of being able to deliver services. And, you know, the focus now, and it should be, is on health and safety. But here's something that I think everybody intuitively knows, is there's the other side of this crisis. And while there's a lot of scrambling going on right now, Tom, there's not a better time to begin thinking about what do we need to have in place now so that when we come out of this, we're ready to roll.
Tad Long is the Director of Community Development Services at the Kentucky League of Cities. Thanks so much, Tad.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.